What I was interested in talking about this evening is has something to do with the subject of conviction. And it's been coming up a lot, belief systems, beliefs, for me lately. This weekend we had a delightful workshop class with the Sati Center with this abbot from Southern California named Tanisaro Tanjeff. And no, I suppose it wasn't at the class. It was yesterday evening. I took him to Berkeley he was going to talk to a sitting group in Berkeley. And someone asked him about cloning. And you know, and he said, "What about it? what does Buddhism think about cloning?" And he was brave enough to offer his point of view. And he said, "No problem." And he doesn't see any problem with cloning, and he proceeded to explain that from his understanding of Buddhism, that with the Buddhist understanding of rebirth, the genetics of cloning is just a kind of a mechanical event, and the person that gets supposed to get born. It isn't dependent on the particular cloning, but it's a very different person. You know, the fact that two people are genetically the same, he would say, actually they have very different karmic streams that go into that person, and so it's not such an unnatural, strange act. What's important is, you know, it's wonderful that person has a chance to get, you know, that person. As I said, that person has chosen to be reborn into that particular situation of being a cloned person, and. So he said, you know, no problem. And I've heard somewhere else that this was in the news a lot a few weeks ago, that some religions like Buddhism and I think maybe Islam also had no problem with cloning. But the way it was talked about in the press and in politics and in our culture in the West in the last couple of months since Dali. Was kind of this horror and hysteria and crisis, and we have to have legislation and laws, and we have to do it quick and soon before it happens. And I don't particularly have an opinion on the subject, but it just strikes me, you know, that there's different conviction systems, different belief systems about this subject, and I sense a kind of certain kind of cultural hysteria around the subject here in the West that. And in hysteria, the belief system which that kind of idea exists in sometimes is invisible, which is often the case when there's a cultural-wide belief system. It's often invisible, the assumptions behind it. But more important than the assumptions, perhaps, is the question of on what is your authority based for this particular convictions? Where does the authority come from that supports the conviction and beliefs we have? And then we had the suicides in San Diego County, and just before that we had the ones in Canada, and quite dramatic example of people acting on their convictions. And then one of the same days last week, where I was reading about the Heaven's Gate, there was an article about the rules and regulations that the Taliban in Afghanistan are imposing on everyone there, and everybody's, you know, it's completely, you know, dramatic situation. The rules get changed, you know, new rules get changed every week, and everybody has to listen to the radio announcement to know what rules do you live by. And it's dramatic if you don't, you know, if you don't follow them, it's pretty dramatic. They talked about one woman who was driving in a car, and part of her arm was exposed, and she was pulled out of the car and beat by the ethics police, and then they had to paint the windows of their homes black, lest someone should look through the windows and see a woman inside. It's amazing, you know, convictions and beliefs that people have. And then we have, you know, this thing, you know, the Heaven's Gate phenomena, and it just reminds us how in America, probably more than any other culture in the world. Has more belief systems and conviction systems and religious systems and philosophies and ways of living and than probably anywhere else on the planet ever. It's phenomenal what goes on here in our culture. And partly because the melting pot, so all these different cultures from all over the world come here. And one of the things that's interesting for, if you ever study the anthropology of religion, is to study, you know, religious beliefs around the world. And also particular subjects from around the world, like how different people in different religious traditions relate to death and dying, and how different people relate to birth or to marriage or to what's ultimate or what has power, what has authority. And what's amazing when you start kind of surveying all the different varieties of ways that human beings have come up with belief systems, how phenomenally diverse they are, how amazingly creative. And suddenly it begins. You begin wondering, how do you know what's true? And it's very threatening to a monolithic culture to begin looking outside of its own culture at other cultures and what they do there, because suddenly you have pluralism. Suddenly you have other belief systems, and how do you relate to that belief system? And are beliefs relative, or are they created, or do you have the absolute and they don't? And from the point of view of our own, you know, again, our own, you know, being situated in our own culture, sometimes it's very difficult to see what we really believe, or looking at the assumptions underneath our beliefs. Someone once said that if you never leave England, you won't know England, implying that if you don't leave, you don't step outside of the situation you're in, sometimes it's very hard and difficult to understand the situation you find yourself in. And in some ways, I believe that's what we do in meditation. Is for some of us at least, we're able to use meditation as a way of stepping outside of our normal convictions and beliefs, not to substitute them with something else, but to get a better view of what they actually are, and to begin investigating and studying them, questioning them, and questioning perhaps what authority do we base these convictions and these beliefs. And I was just a little bit disturbed this week by some of the things that I heard and read about Heaven's Gate. Driving down here today, I heard most of this interview on NPR with this man, Justin or Nick Cook, is that his name? An intelligent man, it seemed like. Very clear and articulate. A true believer in the Heaven's Gate conviction of how things work. And at the end of his interview, the interviewer asked, you know, when you hear the word cult, what do you think? And he said, well, Judeo-Christian culture is a cult. And Muslim is a cult, and Buddhism is a cult, he said. And, you know, people think I get indoctrinated from the time that they're born. And if I compared, you know, some of the beliefs that you read about the Heaven's Gate with other religions I know, including Buddhism. And it's not so far-fetched compared to some things that we believe, or, you know, not me, we, but no me, but maybe it isn't. See, you don't know. And there have been Buddhists in China and Japan, and certain sects of Buddhism, who have had similar belief system as Heaven's Gate, not comets and not just flying saucers, but they believe that there were other realms where you can get reborn into, and there were a lot better realms to be in, so they committed suicide to get there. I've heard that in China recently, in recent years, there was an epidemic at one point of young Chinese peasant women committing suicide because they saw no real prospect for themselves in this life, and they were convinced that they would have better chances next time around, and so they might as well just, you know, check out and try again next time. So convictions and beliefs, and I believe that from the point of view of Buddhism, one of the interesting questions around beliefs and convictions is asking yourselves or exploring, upon what authority do we base our convictions? Upon what authority do we believe in God? Upon what authority do we believe in a particular teaching, a particular belief, and a particular whatever? And often the authority upon which it's based, our beliefs, our convictions, often the ones that are most intimate for us, The authority is unquestioned or unacknowledged or unknown sometimes for us. It's just taken for granted. This is the way it is. The world is flat. And it's obvious and it has to be that way. And, you know, it's always been that way. And why wouldn't it be that way? And this is what you were told. And you'd be fooled to say it wasn't flat. And sometimes, you know, we take things so much for granted, we don't even question the underlying assumptions that are there. And to ask ourselves, you know, upon what authority do we take our belief systems that we have, our convictions about anything? So at the time of the Buddha, there were also many different belief systems circulating. And it seems at the time of the Buddha, there was it was a very active time of exploration in India, a very fertile time. The belief systems of ancient India were the very most ancient belief systems of India and the belief systems of the Aryans invaders who came in from Russia and invaded India and brought with them the Indo-European belief systems that have a lot in common with Norse mythology and Greek mythology because they're related families of religions and cultures. They came into northern India and there was this meeting of these different religions, native Indian religions and this, you know, Indo-European religions. And after they've been together for some centuries and millennia, there seems to have been around the 6th century, time of the Buddha, a very fertile time for, and a very questioning time, exploring time, where people were exploring a lot belief systems and what is true and what was, you know, just... So maybe in some ways it may be comparable to California. And so in some of the sutras that are preserved, this issue of convictions of truths and how do you find the truth in the midst of all this plurality, all these different teachings? Different teachers say this is true, another teacher say this is true, and how do you find out what's true, and to base your life on and your practice on? And often, sometimes the Buddha was didn't hesitate to use rational argument or to use sometimes seemingly, it depends on maybe how you read it, but seemingly humor to point at the fallacy of certain people's, other people's beliefs. He wasn't completely removed from doing that or aloof from doing that. There's a beautiful example of this where perhaps he was using humor. One of the belief systems at the time was that there was this ultimate creator deity who created the universe named Brahman, I guess. And some people apparently believe that he created it. The belief was that the universe was in flux, but this particular form of the universe we lived in was created by him. And so the Buddha argued that this was actually... Brahma's misunderstanding, and it wasn't that Brahma. Buddha didn't deny that Brahma existed, this ultimate God. He just made fun of the notion that he was the creator God. And he said, what happened is that after the last universe collapsed, Buddhism believes in the kind of yo-yo theory or the Big Bang theory of the universe. You know, the universe expands and then it comes back and collapses, and it all disappears and then it blows up again, and you have worlds and human systems and everything, and it lasts for a few long time and then it collapses again. So after one of these great collapses, you know, they were beginning, you know, the universe was starting to get created again. And the way that and it isn't that life disappears entirely, but life kind of recedes into these very ethereal realms for a while, kind of to wait out until things begin becoming habitable again. So, and the first person or first being to kind of get to rehabitate the way team, you know, to come back, is kind of looks around. It comes in, it gets born into this wonderful palace in the heavenly realms of the world. And looks around, and the palace is empty, and looks around the earth, and no one's around, and concludes that that, you know, that he's the only being in existence. And then he has this thought, you know, it's kind of lonely, it'd be nice if there are other people here. Well, because the universe is kind of expanding, everything's kind of coming back into, you know, shape again. Coincidentally, at the same time, some other gods are born in the same palace. And he said, oh, I created them. Because I had this thought, wouldn't it be nice? And he had some other thoughts, wouldn't it be nice if we had this and this? And so other things started happening. And pretty soon you had the, you know, the... you know, many things start appearing, and then eventually Brahma died, because even Brahma, you know, life comes to an end. And the Brahma was, or maybe I forget the story exactly. Maybe it was one of Brahma's attendants. Yeah, one of the people, one of the lesser gods who was born in Brahma's realm, died, and the lesser gods lived shorter than Brahma, so they died and was reborn as a human being, with the ability to remember past lives. And they remembered living up there in Brahma's realm. And remember that it was Brahma, he was the first ever. And Brahma told them that he'd created everything, and there was no reason not to believe him. So therefore, Brahma was the ultimate creator god, and so we should worship and do all these things. And so this was a Buddha's example of how faulty conclusions can be based on perception. The Buddha didn't deny the existence of Brahma, didn't deny that people were born in these realms and could remember past lives and all these things. But in this story, he's saying, yes, you saw all those things, but the conclusions based on those perceptions were faulty. Brahma made a false conclusion when he said, I create, creating all this stuff. So maybe it's a humorous story, kind of making fun of some existing beliefs. But I think more profoundly, it makes us realize how easy it is to come up with interpretations of what we perceive that have nothing to do with what's actually going on, but have more to do with other ideas, you know, their interpretations rather than actual things that happen. But the most famous statement that the Buddha made, especially in the West probably, most famous statement the Buddha made around this issue of convictions and was in the Kalama Sutta, a scripture that, or a teaching that the Buddha gave to a village called the village of the Kalamas. And what I find very interesting is when people came to the Buddha and specifically said, there's all these different teachers around, how do we know who to believe? Who has the truth and who doesn't? It seems that when he was asked that way, the Buddha never wanted to respond directly and say, well, they got it right and they got it wrong, you know. So, rather, he said, "What I'll do is I'll give you some criteria by which you can come to your own conclusions about this." And one time, the Buddha was walking with a large group of monks when he came to a town. A town of the Kalamas. The Kalamas thought, it is very good indeed to see the awakened ones such as these. And so they went up to where the Buddha was and asked him, there are, sir, many different teachers that come to our town. They illustrate and illuminate their own doctrines, but the doctrines of others they put down, revile, disparage, and cripple. For us, sir, uncertainty arises and doubt arises concerning them. Who indeed of these venerable teachers speaks truly? Who speaks falsely? It is indeed fitting, the Buddha answers, to be uncertain. It is fitting to doubt, for in situations of uncertainty, doubts surely arise. You should decide, Kalamas, and this is the famous statement, you should decide not by what you have heard, not by following convention, not by assuming it is so, not by relying on texts, not but because of reasoning, not because of logic, not by thinking about explanations, not by acquiescing to the views that you prefer, not because it appears likely, and certainly not out of respect for a teacher. So that's an amazing list. And this is, you know, then you begin wondering, perhaps from this kind of list, what do we base our convictions on? On what authority? Do we base our convictions on the authority of just because that's what you've heard. You grew up that way, and that's what was told to you, and you know that's the way it has to be. Are your convictions based on the fact that just that's the culture you grew in? Just kind of that's the what you were kind of trained to see. Or is it based on convention? Kind of the same idea. It's just that's the convention around you. So everybody else is believing, so it probably is right. Or by assuming it, so it says here, maybe that could be by intuition. Do you believe it? You believe your convictions because you intuit that this must be the way it is. Or do you relying on texts, scriptures, Bibles, sutras, like this one? Do you rely, you know, because it's in the text, because it's in the scripture, therefore it must be true? Is that the authority that you base your beliefs on? And then it's very interesting for many of us here in the West who have, West is kind of a religion of reason and logic. It says you shouldn't base your convictions on reasoning or logic. Not by thinking about explanations. And not by acquiescing to the views that you prefer. And a lot of people do that. They like that. It kind of suits them well and it helps them out and it's economically better. There's a lot of people who get it's a common phenomena in the world for people to adopt a religion that seems to offer more power, because power has some kind of truth to it. And so in the old days, if you had a god that was more powerful than the local god, you wanted to have allegiance to that more powerful god. And so if I could prove to you my god was more powerful than your god, that was good enough for you, and you would definitely join my god. In the modern world, what's the form this sometimes takes is the religions that seem to have the most that people associate with the most economic development. So that it seems for some people, when they look around the world, it seems that Judeo-Christian culture in particular, like America, they see as a Christian culture, is very successful materialistically and economically. And so it must be the going system. It must be really right. Something's right about it. And so you find people then, I saw a lot of this when I was living in Hawaii, but you find it in Asia and places like Korea. People will become Christians because it seems to be the more powerful religion. It seems to be, really working. It's helping the culture. It's helping getting more things. And perhaps, I don't want to disparage this. There's probably much more going on than just an economic interpretation. But this is maybe an example of how it's very easy to choose a religion based on preferences, on likes and dislikes, what suits oneself, what one's agenda is for one's life. One of the interesting, very interesting questions to explore around beliefs is the relationship between emotions and beliefs. If you can discover what your convictions are, or if you notice it in other people, notice what emotions seem to circulate around those particular beliefs you have. Are there emotions connected to it? Emotions of joy and enthusiasm, emotions of fear, or what are there emotions around it? Or what does it feel like in your body if you kind of really can tune into how it is to have a conviction, to have a belief system, to believe something? What does it feel like in your body? How do you hold those beliefs? Is it simply, very neutrally, kind of, I believe it, I believe it's true, and, that's okay. And someone doesn't believe it, that's fine. Or are we defensive about when other people come with other belief systems, or they criticize us? Or are we holding on to it for dear life, like it has to be so? Like the Woody Allen movie where someone's asked, what do you prefer, truth or God? And then the old man says, I prefer God over truth, because without God, society would just fall into chaos. Because everybody, there's no reason for ethics and people do whatever they want. And he was afraid of the chaos, of the insecurity, and God provided the kind of security. It's the way I interpreted the movie. But he chose, it's very clear, he chose God over truth. So what's the emotion? What's the holding patterns? What happens in our body around a conviction? I propose that often, the stronger the conviction is, often it's not a neutral event to have a conviction. And so explore the emotional nexus, notional connections, the physical connections, the holding connections, the fear connections that might be a part of that. I think it's a very useful exploration. Even if your belief system is true, it might be important to explore the emotions and the holding in relationship to it, rather than just simply having all this extra stuff that's painful. So the Buddha says it's fitting that you should have these doubts, and you should be careful about having. And he says you should not decide on convictions based on this kinds of authority. So then the question is, what's left? What do you think is left?
Personal experience.
And what is personal experience? And how does your personal experience provide you with? Are you going to be like Brahma?
In your body.
And how?
You feel in your body.
And how so?
Somehow, some kind of alignment or not, or some kind of truth in your tissue.
It's possible, but then I wonder. Certain belief systems and convictions prop up other convictions and other beliefs and ego and identity. So, if, for example, if I think that that people who wear blue sweaters, my conviction, someone tells me that people who wear blue sweaters are, the hottest thing going. I could feel my body. That's really, I get a surge of energy, healthy, good energy. I feel more vital, feel more alive, and feel more, and feeling alive is a great thing. That's the ultimate criteria, maybe. I feel more alive in this belief system that men with blue sweaters is really, really great. I have first-hand validation in how I feel inside. You can't defend your belief better, more than that? I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Yes?
Maybe it's a willingness to hold the belief as a theory, the way in science, theoretically, things are held as okay unless something else disproves it.
I see. So there's a kind of sense of maybe some doubt or skepticism or openness, possibility.
Hold it as a theory.
So hypothesis. That's nice. Yes?
What's deep in your heart?
What's deep in your heart?
The longing in your heart.
The longing, okay. Yes.
That Woody Allen smile.
Yes.
I think that in order to evaluate a belief system, we need everything we've got, including our minds. And if we apply the Four Noble Criteria, is it true, is it kind, is it useful, will it lead to harmony? We have to use our minds to some extent.
Great. So your minds means reasoning and logic and things like that.
Uh-huh. That's a belief system also. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes.
Maybe the Buddha was just trying to shake up all the cosmologies in that eloquent statement.
No, the answer's on the next page.
She said the answer's on the next page. But I think that's very, very, very I think it's a very good point. And there are some teachers who like to do that, and some teachers who it's kind of a Socratic method, just in some places you don't offer anything, but you shake everybody else up. And but if you don't offer anybody anything and you only shake them up, some people will get very frightened because they don't feel like any base for their life anymore. Perhaps they would.
It's a koan.
It's like a koan.
The question is just a question. It's not to be answered.
Well, there is an answer on the next page. But if I give you the answer, then you don't have a chance to exercise your own You know, and then you might be intimidated, because then you might not say, you know, you go, well, you know, who am I to say now? And I heard what the Buddha had to say, and because you think, you know, it's in the text after all, and so I don't want to kind of inhibit you by giving you. And is it really the answer? How could it be? How could it be the answer when he says in here that don't believe what you find in the text? Desha.
When I was looking for a group, I didn't know exactly what I was looking for, a spiritual home. And I didn't know why. And I just kept looking until I arrived here. And there was a feeling, I think what other people have said, you know, in my heart, in my body, that, oh, I'm comfortable here. But it's not cast in concrete. I mean, in a couple of years, I may decide, no, this is passé for me, and move on someplace else. But right now, it feels very comfortable. It's kind of like, I think Buddhism agrees with things that I have already decided.
So what my question then is that a conviction or a belief? It's simply coming to a place and feeling comfort there, and feeling some value and feeling that comfort, and then deciding, this is something I want to be more part of. I don't know if that's a conviction or a belief.
Well, I find that what I'm being taught about Buddhism, I agree with.
Well, be very careful now. Very, very careful. You didn't say this. Be very careful not to confuse comfortable feelings with the truth or false, whether you agree or don't agree with something, truth or falsehood with something. One example of this is there's one religious tradition where they do a lot of chanting. And a lot of chanting. And if you do a lot of chanting, you'll feel really good. It's a great way to feel high, get a kind of a rush. And so people will go in and join this group and do a lot of chanting. And they feel so good, better than they've ever felt before. And we'll see if anybody comes back next Monday. Maybe you'll go, you know, where is that? and then people will make statements, which they do. They'll say, something like, it must be true because I feel so good doing the practice. And so they're willing to accept a whole belief system because they feel so incredibly happy doing the chanting. You know, there's all the belief system about the power of the chant and where the chant comes from and what's being channeled and all these different things. It must be true because I feel so good. But actually, if you just took out the Palo Alto phone book and chanted all the names there, the mind could get very concentrated and very blissed out and really feel wonderful. Also, so you have to be very careful by, you know, if it's just a feeling tone that a person gets, and then to connect that to a belief system, it must be true because I feel so good in this kind of situation.
But I find that the beliefs strike me as valid.
Yeah. That's completely fine. Maybe. Yes.
That when I look at my own experience with, you know, looking for spiritual truths throughout my life, it's as though I've looked at them like they're a dot in my life rather than a line in my life. And so there have been many dots along that line, and at each time, each one I've seemed certain about, you know, or that one has been the truth. But what seems more important is the line rather than the specific.
The process or the development.
Mm-hmm. And I, when I heard you list off what the Buddha had said about the things not to do to believe in something, it made me uncertain, because when I heard that, I thought, well, then there's no way to choose a truth, that there is no truth, or there's just what we started out with, which is no certainty. Mm-hmm. And I notice that I'm anticipating an answer to it. The answer is just one more dot on the line of wanting to be certain.
Uh-huh. Yes.
I'm wondering about belief as a whether it's so good to get that, and whether there is not some kind of some lifelessness in there. So when I have my belief in place, then I don't have to look anymore. You know? And I agree with this lady that I really feel comfortable here. And part of why I feel comfortable here is because a little bit of the playing, you know? And I don't know.
So someone said, trust those who seek the truth, but not those who found it.
Along the same lines, you know, it when I was 3 years old, I saw the world from a certain perspective and could only understand it from that way. When I was six, it changed, and again at 12, and again at 20, and on and on. And if that process of going through life is the process of reaching a different rung of a ladder. At each rung of the ladder, I can see a little further out on the horizon. And that evolving process of going through life is where this ongoing living belief system begins to take place. It's evolution, in a sense. And maybe there really isn't an ultimate goal to any of it. That it just continues to move and evolve to other heights and other horizons as we continue to evolve ourselves in our own mental and emotional consciousness.
And so one of the questions is, why do we need beliefs? And what kind of beliefs do we need?
It might help to know where you're going to put your foot next.
Uh-huh.
There's a place to put
Right.
Right. You know, I mean, when I'm walking on a trail on a mountain, I look to see what rocks I can put my feet on and what I can't. And for that moment of that step, I believe in that rock.
Right.
And then I let go of it when I take the next step.
Right. Oh, you know, if you take a class at the university, there's a lot of conviction and belief that you know, there's a lot of conviction and beliefs that go into, you know, that the person, that the professor is going to show up and that you're going to learn something, it's going to be useful for you, and that you'll get the degree, and you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of belief. But so certainly life is full of certain kind of belief or certain kind of trust or conviction. But I wonder if we can differentiate between more commonsensical convictions like that, and you know, knowing the next rock's going to hold you, versus what people would call religious convictions or religious beliefs.
Well, I'm using the rock just as a
metaphor. One of the interesting questions I think that Buddhism suggests that we explore is not just simply the belief itself and the authority upon which we base the belief and all this, but where the need for belief comes from, where the need for meaning comes from. And if we don't ask for that question, then it might simply be like the dots. We fill in a new dot. You know, every few years there's a new dot that fills it, but we never ask, you know, what. Why do I keep looking for a belief system? Why do I keep holding on to a belief system? But if you step back from it and look, why is it I'm looking for it? Why do I need it? You might have a very good, interesting answer, and you'll have a better sense of why what you're looking for. Or perhaps you might find some situations that if you're really honest and turn the mirror back at where the need for a belief system comes from, you might find that you don't need to believe in something anymore. There's no need to have the belief. For example, it could be that there's the need for a belief system comes from fear, like the man who felt like society is going to fall apart if there's, you know, no God, you know, watching over everyone and threatening people so they don't, you know, start living immorally. his need for that belief, perhaps, is based on his fear. And if he doesn't take an honest look at his fear, if that one belief system is to disappear, he's going to look for another belief system to handle and take care of that fear. Joe?
No. I watched the Seventh Gate closer to the 60 Minutes interview on that time as well. And it made me wonder, and it's right in line with what you're saying, the possible beliefs that these people had, and the uncertainty of death versus the certainty of being lifted to another realm and having this belief that this is going to happen. And on the other side is just everyday death, the uncertainty of where do you go from here. And having that belief, I think, would be a very comfortable feeling. Of, you know, going through that process of intentionally killing the body to get to this next stage.
Convictions are extremely powerful. I think we all know that. And convictions can heal. Convictions can kill. Cause illnesses. And because of the kind of certainty, because of many things, many kind of the vitalizing, energizing aspects of having a conviction, even wrong convictions can be healing for people. And so. Well, that's an interesting question. What's the criteria I'm using, you know, to make that word? Wrong in what sense? But but people use anyway. Convictions are very powerful because of I think our psychology, and we hook onto things and the certainty and the safety and all things that we get. One of the interesting things that scholars of religion point out when they survey kinds of religious beliefs in the world and correlate it to what's happening in societies at the time of the belief is that there's a very strong correlation to belief in very strong beliefs and desires for rebirth in some other realm, whether it's heaven or whether it's, you know, in the future. So, where the religion becomes otherworldly oriented, the more strongly the religion is otherworldly oriented, the more strong correlation there is between great social problems in society, and a strong correlation to people in society who are downtrodden and oppressed. People who are so oppressed that they see that absolutely there's no possibility in this lifetime to have any hope of alleviating their suffering. I wouldn't say that exactly, but you should read Marx's full paragraph where that comes from. He puts that quote in a very different context if you read the whole paragraph that is pulled out of. And Marx, I think Marx was a deeply spiritual person. And that we completely lose track of that because we think of him as being very critical of religion and a materialist and an economist. But my sense of him, I read a paper for school once about the spirituality of Marx. So now I've lost track. Where are we?
We're talking about downtrodden.
Oh yes. Yeah, so people who don't find any hope to alleviate their really terrible suffering in this lifetime, will then turn towards all kinds of otherworldly, other next life or future life or heavenly oriented religions, because it provides them with perhaps the only solace, the only hope, the only something that makes their life a lot more livable. So conviction, you know, and the role of conviction and why people settle and take on convictions is a very interesting subject. So asking, you know, not just simply, you know, what authority is this conviction based on, but what's the need for the conviction? What's behind it? The need that kind of is gives a charge to the way in which we all hold on to our belief system. Yes.
You think there's a kind of anxiety about the end of the century, which might be connected with the end of the world, a sense of the end of the world?
That's what a lot of people theorize, that the millennia, end of millennia has, you know, has a lot of meaning in the West, and you know, apocalyptic kind of thoughts and ideas, and some people theorize there'll be a lot more of these kinds of phenomena as we get closer to the year 2000. But it's, you know, for Buddhists, it's what year is it?
It's perfectly arbitrary, whatever year.
Yeah, whatever.
2,583? Isn't that particularly? So I'll read the end of this because it's already 9 o'clock. And one of our convictions is
that the teacher will give the answer.
No. One of our convictions is we're supposed to end on time. And this is somewhat similar to Sarah's. When you know for yourselves that these things are unhealthy, these things, when entered upon and undertaken, incline towards harm and suffering, then you should reject them. And then it goes on, when you know for yourselves that these things are healthy, these things, when entered upon and undertaken, incline towards welfare and happiness, then Kalamas, having come to them, you should stay with them. And what he offers, perhaps, is a pragmatic criteria for beliefs or convictions. Not based on, you know, gut feelings or how it is deep in your heart, because that's kind of like how things. So by paying attention to the consequences is one way to know what is healthy, what is useful, and what we can pursue, what decisions we can make for our lives, and what we can base our life on. Now, all this, I believe, partly I wanted to talk about this tonight because I just finished talking about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path over the last few months. And I think that Buddhist spirituality is not trying to provide beliefs and explanations about all kinds of different things we can possibly want to have. Buddhist spirituality is not trying to give you solutions for cloning, you know, and whether cloning is right or wrong in and of its, you know. Rather, Buddhist spirituality has a very narrow field of interest. And unless we understand that the narrow field of interest, we might get confused about how Buddhism approaches the question of truth and what is not true. And what Buddhism is concerned about is not ultimate truth with a big, maybe capital T, but rather that which is true, pragmatically true, that helps us become healthier, more honest, more happier, freer, more awakened people and society, and support other people in doing that also. And that the value of having people who are, there's a tremendous value in working towards alleviation of suffering. And so the criteria for deciding how we live our life and what kind of belief system perhaps to experiment with, to take on temporarily to see if there might be some truth there, is based for Buddhists and who are following this somewhat, you know, particular path, is this useful for the purposes of alleviating suffering? And other kinds of belief systems, you know, they can be as they wish. And maybe you're involved with them, maybe you're not, maybe there's a reason for being involved in them. You can explore, you know, your assumptions behind those belief systems. But the questions for Buddhists, you know, has to do a lot with freedom and awakening. And from that, because of that criteria, the interest, Buddhists then will look at other belief systems, not so much at the truth or falsehood of those belief systems that we might have, but the way in which we're engaged in them, and we engage with them in a way that is causing ourselves suffering or not suffering. If it's based on our fear, are we really looking honestly at our fear, or are we simply taking a belief system that makes ourselves comfortable? And you could say, well, I'm comfortable, therefore it must be good, because I feel better, I'm suffering less. But that's not really an honest look at ourselves, not really honestly looking at the fear and the roots of the fear. So one of the things that Buddhism offers or suggests in this whole question of beliefs and convictions and what we participate in, is it's very useful to develop a concentrated mind. And if your mind can become concentrated, you can use that concentration use a still and quiet mind that's not scattered and all over the place to investigate and reflect and think about how we are engaged in our beliefs and in our convictions and what they might be and what they're based on and what authority they're based on. And you shouldn't underestimate the power of a concentrated mind as a tool for helping us negotiate our way through our life and through a lot of these questions. And the more deeply the mind is able to concentrate, the more useful tool you have for exploring and part of the function in Buddhism for getting a concentrated mind is not simply to get concentrated for its own sake, not simply to have a wonderful, you know, holistic, unified sense of being present and a refuge from all of life's normal problems. But part of the function of concentration is to be able to use that as a tool to very honestly look at our life and our beliefs and our convictions and our assumptions and our identifications, our holdings, our relationships to ourselves and to others, and know for ourselves. So I hope this was interesting. It was very interesting for me, especially to hear from all of you. Thank you. And I hope it was timely. I had all kinds of feelings and emotions around the news this week around this Heaven's Gate thing. A lot of varied things. Some of my thoughts occasionally were, maybe I should get out of this business. I don't want to be associated with anything that. Yes.
Two things. One story you did mention from you, which I think is related to your talk, was the Muhammad Ali story. Did you hear that?
No.
He talked to the school, and he said even though he is a Muslim, he felt that, or he had the conviction when he went to Hebba that he would see his mother there who was a Christian.
Oh, that's
caused a terrible backlash reaction among fundamentalists. You know.
In all, everywhere.
And the other one is, I want to thank you for your talk tonight and not using the word paradigm once.
Well, from my belief system, I think that Muhammad Ali's example is kind of inspiring, that he has that kind of broad vision. So, thank you all.
Yeah. Are you going to see that in action?
I could eventually. I kind of skipped it.
I know you did.
You miss it?
Uh-huh.
You feel incomplete?
Question. Right action. You know? That one week.
Have you been sick or gone? Or where have you been?
I've been sick and I'm working till 7 o'clock on Thursday and Monday nights. I'm teaching till 7. So.
What kind of sick?
I've got the flu.
Are you okay?
I'm okay now. I actually went out of town also 3 days. After I got the flu, I planned on doing this panchakarma treatment with Dr. Led on this clinic. So it was a great place to be for healing. But instead of working on my chronic issues, I work on my acute flu issues.